Hi, I'm Jared Fuller. Welcome to Scratching the Surface. This week's episode, in many ways, feels like a classic Scratching the Surface episode. We are going to talk about writing, we're going to talk about editing, we're going to talk about designers who write and writing for designers, we're going to talk about publishing and the graphic design of publications and everything in between. I'm joined by someone who has perhaps thought about these things more deeply than anyone else over the last 30 years, Cynthia Davidson. Cynthia is the co-founder and executive director of Anyone Corporation, the nonprofit architecture think tank in New York City that she helped co-found in 1990. With Anyone, she is the editor of the architectural journal Log, which just celebrated its 20th year and 59th issue. Before Log, Cynthia edited Any magazine, which ran from 1993 to 2000. Born out of the 10 annual conferences that Anyone staged from 91 to 2000, Any magazine sought to set the architecture discourse through a series of themed issues with writing from architects, but also writing from critics and theorists and sociologists and economists. Taken together, Any and Log could not be more different. Where Log, which takes its name from the ship's log, is structured like a literary magazine with minimal imagery and observes the architecture worlds today, Any, on the other hand, was provocative. It was pushing questions into the discourse to create discussion. Unlike Log with its minimal design, Any was exuberant. It was designed originally by Massimo Vignelli before Michael Rock and Susan Sellers of 2x4 took it over and featured a vibrant, collaged visual design that mirrored the text itself. I've been a longtime reader and fan of both Log and Any and Cynthia's work generally, and was curious to talk to her about how architecture writing has changed over her career. She originally trained as a journalist and started her career in architecture as the editor of Inland Architect in the 80s. This early work still influences her work today as we talk about the differences between journalism and criticism, resisting the lure of the image in design media and the continued value and relevance of text, as well as the influences for both Log and Any. Cynthia, I think you'll see, is one of those editors who's very conscious of the image and is conscious of visual design. And so we also talk quite a bit about the graphic design choices of both Log and Any and how they reflected and sometimes subverted the texts. This is a fun, thoughtful, and ultimately, I think, optimistic conversation on design writing. And I'm thankful for Cynthia's continued work in this space that I care so much about. If you also care about design writing and liked this episode and what we do here at Scratching the Surface, I hope you consider supporting us on Patreon. Patreon supporters get bonus interviews, full transcripts, an exclusive monthly newsletter, and help keep this show free for everyone all the time. You can head over to patreon.com/surfacepodcast to sign up. Thanks for listening, and here is my conversation with Cynthia Davidson. You've been involved basically in three architecture publications, three major architecture publications. You were editor at Inland Architect from 1983 to 1990, that's 7 years. You did Any magazine from 93 to 2000. You did 27 issues there. And you're working on Log now, which you started in 2003. It's now 2024. You just celebrated the 20th year and you just released the 59th issue. So 7 years, 20 years. How did that happen? You know, looking back on those 20 years, how has that sustained, or how has that sort of lasted longer than these other projects you've worked on?
I don't know. Maybe the pivot was in Philadelphia. In 2010, I was invited to give a lecture about my career in publishing at the School of Architecture and Art at Temple University. And it was the first time I'd ever been asked to do that. And so I put together a lecture. And when I did that, I realized I'd done Inland Architect for 7 years, and I had done Any Magazine for 7 years. And I was now on the seventh anniversary of Log. And I said to the audience, maybe this is a sign I should quit. And there was something about the audience was really full. There were Penn students there too. There were a lot of good questions. And I don't know. I don't know if I was ever serious that I would quit at seven again, because I didn't realize the first two had been pretty similar, for very different reasons. But I didn't quit. I just kept going. And all of a sudden, I think because of the COVID years, we were and working from home and feeling sort of distant from it. All of a sudden, we were 20 years with Log. I don't know how it happened. It was not a plan. It was not a plan.
I mean, I watched a talk that you gave after 10 years. So this was 2013. I think this was at SciArc. And you make a comment at the end. You're like, I don't like, I'm thinking 1 or 2 years is left in this. And here we are sort of 10 years later, and it's still going. And it's still, what's interesting to me and what I'm getting at here is that you've stayed the course, the original mission that you started 20 years ago still feels so central to what you're doing now. Can you sort of take us back to 2003? You started Log sort of post 9/11 New York. You were involved a little bit in the Eisenman competition for the World Trade Center, and sort of felt this need to start a new publication, a magazine, a journal, something new to talk about what you were seeing. Can you take me back to that time and sort of the need that you felt?
First of all, I have to correct you. It wasn't the Eisenman entry. The World Trade Center design competition was a series of teams,
Oh, right.
international and local. So it was Eisenman, Charlie Gwathmey, Stephen Hall, and Richard Meyer
Oh, right.
had formed a team that were selected to be one of the part invited to be one of the participants. Just like there was Greg Lynn, Alejandro Zayarapolo, I think Jesse Reiser might have been on that team. I mean, there were these other
That's
teams.
right. Yeah.
Vignoli was with Shigeru Ben. Kulhas was with somebody. I don't remember all the teams. I think only SOM was by themselves. Anyway, when the partners on the New York team got together, their first design decision was that they wanted to make a book to present to the jury. And so the first person they invited on the team was me. I had finished Any Magazine and the Any conferences that I did in the 90s. And so I was not highly focused on that. And so they brought me onto the team and they hired a graphic designer, a young guy whose name I don't remember now. And he and I produced this book on the competition. I am a real outsider in architecture, and it's the only time I was ever involved in a project anywhere with anyone. And I have worked for architects before, but I'd never been part of a design competition. I fell in love with the project. I understood why Renzo Piano had once said to me, I don't do competitions because my heart's broken when I lose. But I also, having been really involved in discussion and debate and writing and publishing about architecture and architectural ideas, I felt the entire discussion of what happened at the World Trade Center design competition was about image. And this distressed me because my whole life has been a sort of struggle between image and word. And I think it's because I'm a Pisces and the fish swim in opposite directions. But I thought this was the moment that architecture needed a literary magazine, a literary type format that suppressed the dominance of the image. And so I started Log to record the movements in architecture after 9/11 and to do it through word. and not through the dominance of the highly rendered, splashy, beautiful images. I mean, it's the beautiful images of our project that Dbox had rendered that I fell in love with. I mean, the images were spectacular. I thought, wow, if this was in Lower Manhattan, what an accomplishment, right? But now the image can be very seductive, and that's not to say the words can't be seductive, but it's in a very different path in the brain, I think.
And you're right. I mean, all the images I remember seeing at that time, and we won't spend the whole conversation talking about, the World Trade Center competition. They were all of the skyline. They were aerial renderings. They weren't actually about the experience of interacting with that building, of walking by it, of this sort of street level. I think it's interesting. You talk about this being. You wanted Log to feel like a literary magazine. I've heard you say before that you were inspired by McSweeney's, and
Yes, correct.
the sort of format and size was based on
Exactly the
McSweeney's.
format of the first McSweeney's.
How was that first issue received, or when you started sort of producing this, was there a hunger beyond you for talking about architecture beyond the image? Did people feel like that was missing?
I think No, I think people felt there was no place they could write. And when we launched the first issue in September 2003 at the former Urban Center bookstore on Madison Avenue, we served Bison vodka and Red Bull instead of crappy white wine, and people really noticed. And I think they thought this was something new. And the people in the first issue, I realized I had been also sitting on a network of connections I had made in the 90s through Any Magazine and the conferences. And I mailed out 400 postcards to people whose addresses I still had and said, "It's a new magazine. What do you want to write?" And I had Giuliana Bruno and Katherine Ingram and Hubert Damiche. And I mean, people I really respected in this first issue, as well as new voices. I've always tried to have figures that, oh, I want to read what Juliana has to say. But who is Jarrett Fuller? Oh, let me see. Who is that? Why is he here? So that's always been my sort of formula. But it's also a way to sort of push forward because the unknown voices tend to be the younger people. So I felt at the same time that the image was dominant and that the word needed a place. That also architecture was in the midst of a number of shifts in terms of its interests and directions, part of it digital, part of it theory, part of it, the post-critical, all kinds of things. So that Log could track these different movements, not take sides, but see what's happening. I would say it ultimately Log is not conservative, because those voices didn't appear. And maybe that's because they thought I represented something from the 90s that was very experimental and not at all conservative. That probably tinges any new project. But I think that it's endured because there are people who want to write. I mean, there are more and more PhD candidates, right? They have to publish. Now they have gray room. They have their other outlets, SAH. But it's a different audience than what Log is. It's just somehow continued, and it amazes me if I go back now and look at the different things that have happened over 20 years that we really have tracked change. And that's probably why it still is going, because architecture hasn't stopped somewhere in some major movement. It's still wandering around.
That's a really interesting way to put that, and sort of gets to a tension that I was feeling when I was thinking about your work and thinking about 2003 versus 2024. In some ways, a lot has changed, and in some ways, things have not changed. I think that adriftness that you are talking about is something that has persisted. And I also think this dominant, the image domination has also persisted, if not increased. In, I'm going to read to you from your first editorial note of Log issue one. This is fall 2003. You write, "In a culture dominated by the image, filmic and still, is it nostalgic to yearn for a text, for writing? Has the increasing pace of events, of wars, of celebrity, of the next new thing, made the image and the soundbite quick to take, quick to disseminate? The most efficient way to communicate information and ideas, the best way for architecture to record an idea." And I read that 20 years later, and it just, that feels, you're describing now, increasing pace of events, of wars, of celebrity, of the next new thing, dominated by the filmic and still image and the soundbite. That is the world we live in 2024. Can you talk about sort of how the image has persisted and how you sort of thought about that over these last 20 years?
Well, let's think about how many new venues there are for images, whether it's Instagram or, I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know if people post images on Facebook, but TikTok, you know, these short little videos, all the other kinds of places one can share images, so that images are everywhere.
Yeah.
If you get the daily emails from DZine or Dwell, uh-huh, or Arc Daily, it's all about the image with a tiny little caption. Mm-hmm. And so if the image is interesting enough, you might click on the caption, but it's never just a story. It's never just a headline.
Right.
It's just words. So the image is everywhere. It's proliferated. The amazing thing to me just now doing the 20th anniversary, quote unquote, issue was going back to Logs 1 and 2 and, you know, pre-iPhone.
Yep.
When the BlackBerry was all the rage. and seeing what had happened in our pages. In Log 2, I think her name was Chantal Thomas. Mm. She had written about, she's a French thinker. She had written about the cell phone, the mobile phone. And why is everybody always on the phone? They come out of the train station and they're all on the phone. I'm here, or I'm leaving, or where are you? That, yeah, everybody needs to locate each other all the time. And then in the 20th anniversary issue, Log 59, we have another philosopher, the Italian philosopher Emanuele Coccia, saying that our new home is the mobile phone.
Right.
So we are where we are with our phone. And I really started thinking about that, that the mobile phone is now our address, mm-hmm, our line. It's where you mail somebody if you get your email on your phone, right? It's where you text message, it's where you telephone, it's where you pay your bills, mm-hmm, even if it's only a phone bill, right? I thought it was a really interesting thing to think about. So that's a huge change. And the both of them deal with where you are in space.
Yeah.
Which is for me what architecture is about.
Has that change made your work harder? The fact that the image has become even more dominating and alluring since 2003, that the phone has become central, that there are now dozens of places where people can publish writing from, you know, the caption to the photo to, you know, like, how has that changed what you do? Because, like, going back to my first comment about Log, is it's really sort of stayed the course. It's sort of resisted all of these changes in a lot of ways. Has that become harder? Are there still people who want to write in the way that Log is publishing?
Yes, there are, but there were never a lot of them. Right. Let's not exaggerate, yeah, right? There were never a lot of people who want to write thoughtfully and at at some length, meaning more than 240 characters, about architecture, right? Because it requires too much thought, too much effort, too much work. Writing is not easy. And editing, I'm beginning to think, is even more difficult.
You're just beginning to think that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm tired.
Okay.
I mean, I teach writing. You've taught writing. People realize that an image doesn't necessarily transmit the narrative that they would like to accompany it. And the narrative comes through words, whether it's through words that are spoken, as in this podcast, or through writing. I mean, I think it's interesting that so many people today say to me, oh, did you hear this podcast? Did you hear that podcast? And not very many people say to me, did you read this? Did you read that?
Right.
So people may actually be switching away from the image because they're listening to podcasts, because they're oversaturated with images, if I were to think about it. But if you're listening to something, whether you're commuting or, well, I know somebody who likes to listen to podcasts when she's cleaning her apartment. Because you can't read when you're cleaning, but you could read on the subway, sort of. That they're getting their information in so many different ways.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
But there are people who need to write and who want to write. And you could also ask me, why am I still doing print and not digital? But if you look at something like Efflux, which is also another, Efflux architecture is another venue for writing now. I'm subscribed to, I think, every single platform they do, education, art, criticism, architecture, et cetera, right? And occasionally I'll see an architecture piece I want to read, because you'll read the first two paragraphs, then you have to go to read more, right? I don't have time to read it right then, so I'll save that email, but do I go back to that email?
Right.
Do I actually read the rest of it, or I get caught up in other things? So reading, I think, in general, it's very, people can read images quickly, or they think they can.
Yeah.
But that's generally superficial, or they can sit with what I call the slow space of the page and try to think about what they're reading, raise questions about what they're reading, make notes in the margin. It's a different kind of tool for thought.
I think when you're reading online, there's a sense, or reading digitally, it doesn't even have to be online, there's a sense that you're never going to finish. There's always another link to click. There's always something else. There's another rabbit hole. There's another tab opened. And, you know, when I sit and read Log, or, you know, any of the stack of magazines that are right off this side here, there is a, you know, there's a sense of completion that I have finished something, which feels nice to me as somebody who grew up in the, you know, the image dominated culture. There's still something sort of satisfying about that. And I want to connect that to something you said earlier about Log being a way to observe architecture. And you talked about when you started, you described it as the discourse being adrift. And the title Log comes from this idea of a ship's log, which is sort of this record. And I'm wondering how you think about sort of, you know, how each issue can be a survey of what is happening, a way to sort of bring disparate ideas together that otherwise might not go together. Log is not always themed. You occasionally have themed issues, but, you know, you're taking submissions. I assume you're commissioning stories too sometimes.
Yeah, I have to. Yeah.
And it becomes this sort of kaleidoscopic view of what people are talking about or what might be interesting. How do you think about binding those ideas together? You know, that these pieces might not all go together, but by binding them together, they are now in dialogue with each other.
Log is uncanny in a certain respect. When we have an open issue, meaning no theme, and yes, I always have to commission pieces to know that I have a base, right? Or people approach me, that have written for Log in the past and say, I'm working on X, would this interest you? And I say yes or no. So, and I know what I'm going to get, mm-hmm. basically. Then we have the unsolicited submissions. And I don't know if it's time of year or whatever. And those vary from 40 to 60 pieces an issue.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A lot. And there's always one or two or three students in there. And the lengths are different. But what's uncanny is that as we make our selections as to what is great writing, great idea, a new perspective, from a place we've never published before, meaning, you know, a city or a country that hasn't been represented and would be really nice to have that. It's almost like we have stuck our finger in the wind, like a sailor, to see which way the wind's coming from. And three or four pieces will absolutely be circulating around the same idea, or and they're not saying the same thing, but they're really related in uncanny ways that we didn't anticipate. So we'll say, oh, so this is what's in the wind now, this season or this year, you know, whether it's some sort of new physics engine or, you know, whatever, climate issue, some new building material, whatever. It's there's more than one voice submitting something, and they're not redundant. That it's not redundant to do them all.
Right.
Not the same thing.
And that happens by accident. You know, you're not
by accident. No. Yeah. And we don't look for that.
Right.
We may have commissioned a piece and income two more uncommissioned.
Right.
Unsolicited, that sort of support that idea.
Yeah.
Or are in dialogue with that idea. And so there becomes this sort of little eddy in the issue around which several ideas are circulating. But we don't point that out, by the way. That's up to the reader to figure out, because they may not agree with us.
Right. I mean, I think that's what's interesting about it too, is that, you know, they're not explicitly themed, but then you start to, you know, if you are reading closely, you start to see dialogue, you start to see connections within the issue and across issues.
Yes. Yeah.
I want to contrast that a little bit with Any magazine, actually, which was themed, and, you know, that grew out of the larger Any project that, you know, you mentioned earlier started in 93, or Any started in 91. The magazine started in 93.
Yes.
Part of this larger project, you were doing events all around the world. You were making books, but you've explicitly talked about Any as being an activist magazine, as not wanting to observe, but wanting to sort of set the discourse or, you know, point to the discourse. How does that approach? How do you approach those differently, from being observer to being activist or sort of like discourse driver?
Well, precisely because, well, Any and Log are not even fraternal twins.
Right. Yeah. That's why I'm asking. They're so different.
Yeah. Purposely, because I had done Any. So I had to do a different project afterwards. I wasn't going to continue the same thing. When Any stopped, because it was absolutely no money left still, so to speak, when Any stopped, I was not going to do anything for a while. And it's only because of the World Trade Center design competition and the whole sort of shift in attitude that I thought, well, I need to do another magazine, but it has to be completely other. So Any was always meant to activate discussion, to have I worked with guest editors who had thematic ideas. Often the magazine had an event, and then the in New York, we were working with the Guggenheim Museum, we would do these Saturday events at the Dia Dance Space in Soho, with Tom Krenz as sort of coming in and saying blah blah blah, and then he would leave, and we would have these things. And We did architecture in the feminine with Jennifer Bloomer as a guest editor. We did electrotecture with Mark Taylor as a guest editor. I forget what we called it, but it was about Seaside with David Mone as the guest editor. So that these events were then the people who participated then wrote in the issue, or their presentations were published in the issue. The one on Seaside was really interesting because it was really treated as a kind of political project.
Right.
For the gated communities and the sort of design rules and all these things. And up north, we don't like that stuff happening in Florida. But Dwani and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg were there, and we did the whole issue on this event about Seaside. But Dwani said, I need to be able to respond to everybody's piece in the magazine.
Right.
I said, fine. And so graphically, like Mark Linder's piece appears, and then there's all these red little boxes and lines that are Dwani responding to things that Mark said, for example. So it was meant to activate discussion about issues and theoretical ideas in architecture. We did one on justice. We did one on whiteness. We did one on Buckminster Fuller. We did one on Tafuri. We did one called Diagram Work that Ben Van Berkel and Caroline Boss did. So there were many themes that we investigated that were, well, not even investigated. We didn't investigate. We launched them. Like, what about this? Talk about this. What do you think about this? It was meant to activate discussion. So log is the opposite. Log is a receptacle of discussion that's already going on.
You described the launch of Log as the architecture discourse feeling adrift, feeling like there weren't sort of central points of discussion. And you're describing any as launching, you know, discussion, launching sort of these ideas out into the world. Can you sort of put any into the larger context of architecture discourse? Was that adrift in the same way that it was in the early 2000s? I'm much more familiar with the 90s graphic design discourse with Emigre magazine, postmodernism, the, you know, desktop publishing, and sort of how that in, you know, there were these sort of central themes that everybody in graphic design was talking about. Was it similar in architecture?
I don't think so. I mean, there were so many things going on. I mean, when we started the ENI conferences in 91, Jacques Derrida was there in the first two conferences. But the younger generation was much more interested in Gilles Deleuze. Mm. So over the course of the conferences and in the magazine, you see this shift philosophically from Derrida to Deleuze. Other kinds of things like that. I mean, we did a design competition for the virtual house.
Oh, right. I was looking at that issue.
Which was meant to sort of discuss the idea of the virtual space, which was something that Mark Taylor had raised in 1994 with this idea of electrotecture and the event he did with Avital Ronell and Alakair Stone and other people talking about the chat rooms, all these early internet things that, you know, your generation doesn't remember because you didn't interact with them.
Right.
But that Mark was very quick. He's a professor of religion and philosophy who was a Kierkegaardian and very quick to understand that this was new space and how was architecture going to deal with this spatially? Mm-hmm. Architecture's role. What did architecture need to be thinking about? So we're launching these ideas. They're like throwing little hand grenades, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Think about this. And if anything, I mean, again, Emanuele Cocha says in Log 59, architects need to pay more attention to virtual space. And he's saying this like now 27 years after Mark Taylor. I mean, come on. So architecture is maybe a little slow on that particular territory. I think architecture is much more focused on environmental issues now, climate change, how architecture is to blame and how architecture can solve the problem and all kinds of strange psychodramas about how architecture is going to move forward. But it was different in the 90s. It was different atmosphere. It's more about criticality, more about theory. And but then the digital comes in with a real force. You know, it's much more than CAD, much more than Form Z. You start getting Rhino and Maya and all kinds of other kinds of programming and all kinds of new rendering tools, and architecture gets really caught up, I think, in modes of representation again.
Yeah. I want to maybe connect sort of that text and image piece a little bit there. You know, I watched a bunch of lectures that you've given over the years to prepare for this, and I was really struck by how often you discuss the design of these publications, the graphic design of these publications. And as a graphic designer, I was sort of interested in how central that was to how you talk about all of these publications. Log, you know, like you said, has a very, very simple layout. It's like a literary journal designed by Michael Bayrut. Any, for the first 8 issues, were designed by Massimo Vignelli in a very Vignelli, you know, everything you know about Vignelli, that is what Any looked like. And then you hired Michael Rock and Susan Sellers sort of right before they became 2x4 to design issues 9 through 27. Very, very different visual style. Mm-hmm. Much more experimental, playing with a lot of what we think of as sort of 90s, you know, experimental, you know, sort of editorial design. How did that shift from Vignelli to Michael and Susan, and the visual change there, the dramatic visual change there, how did that change how Any was received, if at all, or how the writing was read? Can you talk a little bit about sort of the presentation of the writing and how that maybe changed how the discussion would happen?
I don't think I was so aware of it at the time, although I became aware of it. Vignelli had agreed to do the Any books and the to do a sort of, you know, master grid fonts, colors, paper, gratis, because of his long relationship with the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies in New York in the late 60s, 70s. And so this was very nice. And there was a woman named Judy Geib who had worked with Vignelli, who would lay these issues out for us according to his template. And then we would go to Massimo's office and show him, and he might make a little correction here or there, or say, you know, angle this more. He wanted Any to have a feeling of informality, as if the photos had been thrown down on the page. Mm. And so there were things that were, everything was thrown down on the page. There were things that were within the grid.
Right.
But the fonts were very clear, mm-hmm. and crisp, because he only works in 4 fonts. And the colors were warm red and black, Vignelli's colors. Mm-hmm. My guest editor in Any number 5, named John Reichman, an art philosopher, historian, teaches now at Columbia. He did an issue called Lightness, and he said, do we really have to do warm red? And I said, well, we'll ask Massimo. And Massimo let us change to blue for that issue, a kind of nice sky blue. And then I was at a lecture, and you've probably heard this story before. I was at a Colin Rowe lecture at Yale, and I drove back to New York with a couple of people who had been at the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies. And they said to me, you need another designer, because Vignelli is just too associated with the Institute, and your project is completely different. So I asked Sheila de Bretville if she wanted to do it. She said, no, I only work in billboard scale now. I don't do publications anymore, but I can give you a list of some young designers. And she wrote down 3 designers. And the first names on the list were Michael and Susan. So I started at the top of the list. And I met Michael and Susan, and they had hardly done anything. They've done a couple of RISD posters and,
you know, right.
But I really liked them. And so I said, well, why bother interviewing the rest of these people? So I hired them, and they were upset because I told them there was one thing they couldn't change. Well, other than the trim size, they couldn't change Massimo's logo that he had designed for the
right. Right.
And ultimately they do change it over the course of But it was very exciting. They were moving to New York in a fifth floor walk up, and I would go up there and they were, you know, really digitally engaged. Whereas Massimo didn't use the computer, he was drawing, which was also fabulous, right?
Right.
Even though Judy Guy was using the computer to put it together. You know, their ideas about changing the color every signature so that the magazine looked, so it was always two over two, but the color changed every signature, so the magazine looked colorful.
Right, right.
Loved metallic inks, right? So they particularly loved silver. So the first issue, which they did as the unofficial, Annie was the unofficial catalog for the first OMA exhibition at MoMA, Office for Metropolitan Architecture. It was silver and blue, but inside it was also orange, because I said, we have to use orange because Holland is colors, their team colors, orange. So all these things. And my phone rang off the hook. Who designed this? Who is this? How do I reach them? Who is this? And their careers took off like rockets.
Yeah.
The design world with REM, with Mark Taylor at University of Chicago Press, with Princeton School of Architecture, with Knoll. I mean, it just rolled like a snowball downhill, which was great for them. But I think that the magazine became, over the course of our working together, highly graphic.
Yeah, yeah.
Prized for its graphics. And there were times where I wasn't all that happy about legibility of the texts, and I would receive complaints from writers and readers that they couldn't Xerox a page. I mean, it was right. already hard enough to Xerox because it was a tabloid format. As the text disappeared on Xerox because of the layers of ink or because it was reversed. And so I think for them was a highly graphic project, even though they said they read every single article that I published so that they knew how to lay it out. I think over time, maybe they didn't. So there was, towards the end of that series, they had become so successful, I started to not be able to afford them. So I had several people doing issues for, designing issues for me in the style of 2x4. But when Annie ended with number 27, I went back to Michael, because at one point when we had an issue that was heavily Gilles Deleuze, Michael said, oh, I want to do a folded issue.
And right.
I said, that's too literal. No. I'm sorry. No.
Right. Because Deleuze was talking about this idea of the fold.
Right.
And so
Everybody
he wanted to actually,
Everybody was into the fold in architecture and philosophy, blah, blah, blah. Right. And so Michael wanted to do something. It's just folded. And I said, no. But when we got to the last issue, I said, Michael, I'm coming back to you because I want to do the issue that's only folded. No trim, no bind, because then people won't know if it's unfinished or coming apart. And he did the last issue for us.
Okay.
Which I think is beautiful. Each article is a poster, because the way the issue folds together, the way it unfolds, you get this huge sheet that poster size, and it contains one article.
It's interesting. It's interesting that you say that they were really interested in silver ink. I feel like they're still very interested in silver. I mean, Michael wrote a piece in the New York Times just a couple of years ago about metallic, the use of metallic in fashion and graphics. And so I did not realize that interest went back 30 years.
Funny, because one of the guest edited issues that Wes Jones and Los Angeles architect did was called Mechintecture, which was a response to Electrotecture about six issues later. And once again, Michael and Susan wanted to do silver ink. And I said, no, because this is about conducting electricity, and electricity moves through copper wire. And they said, oh, I said, you have to use copper ink. And they did. And for me, it is absolutely the most beautiful issue we ever did in terms of color, because copper on top of black makes an amazing kind of resonance on the page. It's just, it's like an aura. It's very different from silver.
I love it
once.
I am loving these sort of behind the scenes inside stories of the printing of any that you don't get that on any other podcast. You don't get that in a Cynthia Davidson lecture. I have a couple quick questions to wrap up. I know you're very interested in prepositions. You think a lot about whether you're writing for architecture, in architecture, about architecture, out of architecture. I'm wondering if you could sort of think about the relationship between media and the architecture profession. And how you think about those differences when it's architects writing about architecture, when it's, you've mentioned philosophers and theorists who are writing about architecture, when it's sort of in architecture writing out, how does that change? How do you think about the changes in modes of writing depending on audience and where the audience sort of sits in relationship to architecture as a practice?
I don't think about audience. I think about the position of the writer in relationship to the object or idea. I've never been one for focus groups. I always edit for surprise. I always want to, I hope that in this over-mediated world we live in, that I can actually present somebody with a surprise. In thinking about architecture and the city today, I think stories about what the possibilities of architecture can be are important, and they're important to be written from multiple points of view. So you kept saying about,
yeah, not yeah.
On or in or with, so or toward, all these other prepositions. But I really came to this thinking about the relationship of the writer to the subject or object at hand through Jane Rendell's work at the Bartlett. She has a project called Site Writing, which she really addresses the art object, but she comes out of architecture. And she talks a lot about the relationship of the viewer or the critic or the writer to the subject they are writing about, the subject or object. And I think that's really important. And then it's up to the reader to sort of figure that out. Also, I've done writing architecture in many ways. I edit a series at MIT Press called Writing Architecture.
Right.
Preposition.
Yeah.
Writing architecture, meaning can we write with architecture itself?
Yeah.
I mean, think about go into semiotics or BART or the idea of what does a word represent? What does a building represent? And as we're covering buildings now with signs that speak something else, the building is just a signboard, but yeah. You know, the steeple means something. It's saying something. And in all this discussion we have today about how, oh, the object is saying something, like my pepper mill is saying something to me, but I don't say, oh, my facade of my building is saying something to me, or the space I occupy is saying something to me. Do we hear that? What is architecture speaking or saying? And how do we recount that? When the first issue of any magazine, which was number zero, was called Writing in Architecture.
Yeah.
Meaning you could take that several ways, because it's like writing in ink, writing in architecture, writing in architecture, filling in the blank with the word architecture. I mean, you could think about the word, I mean, because I'm a crazy word person, right? I think about these tiny little words in important ways. Michel Serres, the French philosopher, in his book on angels, very beautiful book, he talks about how angels are like prepositions. Or prepositions are like angels because they deliver messages. The angel Gabriel delivered a message to Mary, right? The preposition is also delivering a message, but we read right over them. And so I've become sort of deeply interested in the preposition.
I watched your talk that you gave a couple years ago online, where it was called Writing in of About Architecture. I had an existential crisis after. I completely, you know, existential crisis. I was like, oh, I've been using the wrong prepositions for the last 15 years. With that in mind, something that is really interesting to me about you is you've edited a lot of architects. Central to your work is architects writing about architecture. And, you know, I mentioned to you my early interest in the parallels in the process between designing and writing. What do you think architects who are writing about architecture are able to bring to the conversation that an outsider does not? Or is there an approach that is different when you're writing from architecture?
Well, I think there are a lot of people doing that today. Michael Meredith, for one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that, there are architects who write about architecture from different perspectives. I mean, Pier Paolo Tamborelli, the Italian architect, writes about Bramante, right? And writes mm-hmm. beautifully about Bramante. It's a different perspective. Peter Eisenman wrote about Palladio, and he's just finished a manuscript I'm going to publish in the Writing Architecture series on Alberti. So that when you have architects, not historians, but architects writing about architecture or architectural ideas, it's not the same as an historian. It's a different perspective. They've sort of got their hands dirty in a different way. But I think the best example is Rem Koolhaas. Because when we did the writing and architecture issue of any, not every architect was free to write at that moment. They couldn't take the time to write. And one of them was Rem. And so I interviewed Rem and asked him, why did he write Delirious New York? And he said he had to write a book because there was no possibility for him and his partners at the newly formed OMA, because they formed only a couple years before Delirious New York came out. There was no way for them to practice the kind of architecture they wanted to do unless he created a setting or a stage for it. And he could only do that through writing, through changing people's mindset. So hence Delirious New York, a retroactive manifesto through which he worked out a lot of his own ideas about the city, because after all, was for metropolitan architecture.
Right.
Also believed he was creating a conceptual environment in which OMA could now work. And to this day, I believe, but he said this in 1993, and I think it's no doubt still true, that when he has a project, he doesn't make a drawing like Frank Gehry. He doesn't make a sketch or a scribble. He writes words.
Oh, interesting.
What is the ambition? What is the goal of the project? He uses writing. And I always tell this story because I teach architecture graduate students writing. I tell that story because I say, you know, you have to prepare a narrative about your work as an architect in order to do that work.
After 7 years of log, you said, this might be it. After 10 years of log, you said, this might be it. You have not said this might be it in this conversation at all. What are the things you're interested in right now? Or what are the things that you are, you mentioned an Eisenman book that you're going to publish, but is there anything else that you're sort of wanting to do next or things you're thinking about next? And then the second part of the question is, do you see new trends or new issues in architecture discourse generally that are sort of bubbling up and percolating right now?
Well, I've always done the Writing Architecture series books. I've done 26 of them now, I think. We started in 1995. The Eisenman book, I'm publishing Tony Vidler's last book, posthumously. I'm working with Sylvia Lavin and Dora Epstein Jones on manuscripts they're doing for the Writing Architecture series. So I like working on the books, because I'm only dealing with one author. And with log, we're working with between, let's say, 16 and 22 authors per issue. So it's a lot of balls in the air. And some always need more work than others. So some are easier, some take more time. But I like it, and that steals away time to work on the books. But I also find that even though writing is difficult, I don't do enough of it. Mm. And I would like to do more writing, I think, now. So I have to figure out how to do that. Also, as you know, I teach now at 3 different graduate schools in the New York area, writing to architecture students. And this is not something I ever sought out.
Right.
I was asked one day after I was on a jury at Pratt in Brooklyn, had I ever thought about teaching writing? And I said, no. And they said, well, would you consider teaching writing to our graduate students? And I said, well, we can talk about it. And I found out I really like it. I really enjoy the students, even though I think it's very challenging work, because teaching it as a seminar, and I almost feel with here and there, I should be teaching as a tutor. And I don't want to be, I don't want to be a tutor.
Right.
Because I'm not teaching remedial English, right?
Right, right.
I teach them, I give them assignments every week. You have to go out and look at something. You have to think about it. And then you have to write 250 words because 250 words is really difficult.
Yeah.
You have to figure out what you want to say and make a point.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, also, I don't want to read more than 250 words.
Right. Well, that was going to be my last question for you, actually. This is a question I used to end all of these. And I don't know how you have time to read for pleasure, if you do at all, but I'm curious what you're reading right now.
I have so many books here. I'm somebody who, if I were starving, I would buy a book before I'd buy the bread.
Yeah, me too.
And yet I would actually eat the bread before I'm molded, and the books pile up because I can't get through them all. I started a research project last summer on Biosphere 2 in Arizona. A stack of stuff that I need to read in order to write something meaningful about it. I used to be a voracious fiction reader, but now I'm just trying to read Middlemarch because I never have. And everything I'm reading for school, right? I'm reading, what are the new texts, like Jenny Odell on time? You know, what are the new texts that I need to read to keep sort of current thinking in front of the students in a writing course?
Yeah. Well, so can I ask you this? I know I said what you're reading is the last question, but what have you read recently that you feel like has sort of changed how you think about something, or has influenced how you're teaching or the work that you're doing?
What have I read recently? No, it's just stuff like Michelle Serre on Angel, Book on Angels, right? Yeah. Only through, which is really something I only discovered through teaching. Like, I never wanted to teach because I didn't realize that when you teach, you could actually teach things you're working on. I thought it was like my first grade teacher. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess my new discovery is Jenny Odell. Yeah. Thanks to Sarah Whiting at Harvard, who said to me, "You haven't read Jenny Odell?"
Yeah, Jenny's great. I had her on the show a couple of years ago.
People tell me, you know, people say to me, have you read this? Have you read that? I just came across in editing, a footnote on Marsha, somebody who's written a book on how geologists think about time. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to get this book. I looked it up. I started reading the excerpt. And I said, this woman writes beautifully. I have to get this book. So I will get that book. But yesterday I was at a talk at Princeton by a guy named Dennis Tenen, who teaches at Columbia, called Literature for Robots. It was fabulous. It was all about how we're afraid of ChatGPT taking over writing, but he's realized that in his study of literature, he overlooked the labor of producing writing. And then found all these manuals for, 36 plot summaries, or, so that as a wannabe writer, there are guides to tell you how to write these kinds of books and to make a living. So that writing has always been sort of formulated. ChatGPT is just another collective thought project that allows us to write.
I can't tell if that's a a positive or a negative way to end this conversation. I think it's positive. I think you're saying, I mean,
you know what it is? You know what it is, Jared? It's just that it's always going to change. Writing is always going to change. The image will probably always change. And we can't be afraid of change.
That is the editor in you tying up this whole conversation in a perfect summation. Cynthia, this was so fun. I'm a longtime fan of your work and just the way you approach your work. And so this was really nice to chat with you and sort of hear how you think about all of it. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Jared.
That was my conversation with Cynthia Davidson. It was recorded on March 6th, 2024. Our theme music is by Jeremiah Chu. The show is and always will be free thanks to the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you like what we're doing, I hope you consider supporting us and get some bonus content each month. You can follow us across social media at Surface Podcast, and you can listen to all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts and at our website, scratchingthesurface.fm. Thanks for listening.